And a jolly good afternoon to everybody here at Money Talk on Channel Radio. My name is Simon Webster. Welcome to the show. I'm here with Paul Andrew.
Hello there, how are you?
Very well indeed, thank you. What have you done with the sunshine, Paul? It's been sunny.
I know. Well, we've got a meeting down here tomorrow, so I think we've saved it for tomorrow, Simon, to be honest. It's not too bad, though. At least it hasn't rained here. It's raining in lots of other places.
No, it was drizzling yesterday afternoon at home.
Glastonbury and Wimbledon are both under cloud.
There are 200,000 people at Glastonbury. I saw some pictures the other day.
Mm.
Not good. And my other guest today, I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Harry Masson.
Hello.
Hi, Harry. You better tell everybody who you are. So who you are and where do you come from? It's like blind date.
Okay. From Medway, and I'm an independent financial advisor working for Facts and Figures.
Well, that makes two of us. Well, good afternoon. Today we're going to be talking about auto-enrolment, an exciting subject that I'm sure you're all thrilled about, but the fact of the matter is it's going to impact on every single employer and every single employee in the country. And if you don't do it right, there's massive fines for non-compliance. But before we start, if you email ifa@fffp.co.uk, that's ifa@fffp.co.uk, which is the house website, or tweet moneytalk_guru, we will send you our free white paper on auto-enrolment.
Wow.
Yes, I know. It handcrafted in China by skilled financial advisors. We've tried to encapsulate.
So it's not hand-rolled on the thighs of dusky maidens or anything then?
No, that would be a nice thought. It would be a nice thought. I wish. But of course, as my business partner is my wife, I have to be extremely careful
about that. Explain it. Okay.
Yeah, you have to be extremely careful on that one. But we've got this white paper on auto-enrolment. It's only 6 sides long. And it actually covers most of the points that we're going to deal with today. So you don't have to spend a lot of time writing copious notes or going, oh my gosh, how is this going to work? You can actually look at it. And if you're really enthusiastic, you could even go to the Facts and Figures website, which is just straight www.fffp.co.uk. And if you do so after about 3 p.m. today on Friday the 27th of June, I say that in case you're listening to listen again, I'll put a link to our news feed on the homepage there so you can just pick it straight up. So there you go. So let's start with a question. I want to get Harry working before he's even been here 5 minutes. So auto-enrolment. Harry, why do you think it was introduced?
Well, essentially because not enough of us are saving for retirement. We've got an ageing population, which I believe you talked about before. When the state pension was introduced over 100 years ago, people on average lived only 2 years. Now people live more than 20 years in retirement. And we've got a situation where in about 20 years' time, there's only going to be 2 people working for every person retired. And state pension is currently paid for out of national insurance contributions that you and I pay today. So the government's got a huge crisis and they need to encourage us to save for retirement.
I think you're absolutely right. They've already done it in Australia, and in fact the UK model is based on what they've been doing in Australia. And the interesting thing is a lot of gloom and doom merchants, and I'm afraid I have to include myself in that one, when auto-enrolment was first mooted, we said only about half the people that are auto-enrolled are going to play, and the take-up rate has actually been the thick end of 80%.
Mm-hmm.
So surprisingly, it seems to be working, and that's very good news for the employees. It's just not such good news for the poor old employers who've got to set it up. But in fact, the government's been playing with pensions for years. And the state pension system was actually introduced in about 1946. And since then, they've made succession of changes year after year. And I just made a little list here. I thought people would be amused by this brief history lesson. But the state old age pension was introduced in 1946. In 1978, they realised it wasn't enough. And they introduced what they then called the State Earnings Related Pension Scheme, or SERPs. You remember SERPs?
We've all got some SERPs.
But the trouble is, by 1988, so only 10 years later, which in political terms is 5 minutes, they suddenly did, we got our sums wrong. We can't possibly afford this. And they effectively halved the benefits of SERPs. So you went from a pension that, broadly speaking, was going to double the basic old age pension to a scheme that would, for most people, increase it by about 50%. And they did it almost overnight. So it was a pretty major disaster. They also introduced in 1988 personal pension plan, so we went from something called Section 226 retirement annuity contracts, an exciting technical term for the purists, to personal pension plans, which sort of heralded the new pensions freedom. But of course, nobody suddenly rushed out and bought one because it was now all easy. So that was the next stage. But then, of course, in 1997 was what I regard as the biggest single scandal ever perpetrated by government, when Gordon Brown raped the pension funds of every UK taxpayer when he abolished the dividend tax credit that pension funds used to get. So now pension plans have always been growing totally tax-free. From 1997, Gordon Brown stuck his hand in everybody's pocket and started stealing the tax on the dividends that we have enjoyed up till now.
Absolutely. One of the other problems, though, while we're having a go at politicians, and quite rightly we're having a go at politicians because they should be had a go at, is that all the way through this, since 1946, politicians come up with these pension schemes and employers and employees pay into them, but of course the government have never ring-fenced that. They actually go and spend the money on stuff.
Yeah. Well, there's two elements, isn't there? There's the state pension, which is not forward funded, and I think that's what you're talking about. And then there's the private pensions that people set up separately, of course, what happens to that money is between the members and the employers.
But government schemes, national insurance and all those things, goes into general taxation, and then they waste it, then they spend it on public services.
They do.
So it's not ring fenced to actually build the pension pot, which is why they can never afford it.
No, not good news at all. In 2001, the next stage was to introduce stakeholder pensions, and the big thing with stakeholder pensions was every employer with more than 5 employees had to have a stakeholder pension. The interesting thing was 98% of stakeholder pensions had no money in them. So a lot of employers have been lulled into a false sense of security by the announcement of auto-enrolment, thinking it's stakeholder mark 2, and they'll just fart about for a bit, do not very much, and then all of a sudden nobody will join and they'll be fine. But in point of fact, what will actually happen is they'll get a tack on the door from the pensions regulator and they'll get a big fine for not doing it correctly. So employers have got to be really very careful. But stakeholder pensions introduced in 2001, huge failure. There are some legacy rules that make personal pensions ever more attractive, but they haven't really been widely taken up. In 2006, we had pensions simplification. And if ever there was an oxymoron there, everybody in the studio is now rolling on the floor with their legs in the air, because pension simplification actually did work if you were a new pension. But if you were an old pension, all the legacy and transitional rules made it even more blooming complicated than it had been before. As financial advisors, we loved it because everybody had to ask us what to do and we had to bill them for that, which was great. But for poor Joe Public, it was a nightmare, an absolute nightmare. The next thing that came after that, of course, was auto-enrolment. And auto-enrolment is the next big thing, and that's the one that everybody has to watch, because if you don't do something about auto-enrolment, then you've got a real problem. And auto-enrolment is going to be the major focus of what we talk about today. But while we're on the subject, the other thing that's been going on in the background is that they've been messing around with people's state retirement ages. Now, we've got a couple of intelligent business people in the room. One of them is actually a financial advisor. I'll ask Paul first, because there's a good chance that he won't know the answer. What is the state retirement age these days, Paul?
The state retirement age?
Yes, or the state pension age, I should say, to be more clear.
Male for now.
Let's go with male.
68.
Well, it's a good guess. It depends on how old you are, is actually the answer.
Right.
And you need a table to actually work out what people's state retirement age is. Because it used to be dead straightforward. It was 65 for blokes and 60 for females. Then we had equalisation and women had to work as long as men, which seems fairly fair because they live longer than men anyway.
Yeah.
That's probably because they got all that time off. And I get calls about that. and then they started ratcheting the retirement age out for men. So 65 on 1 month, 65 and 2 months, 65 and 3 months. It literally goes through right the way up to 67, I think, is the oldest at the moment, but you might be right. 60. Yeah. It is 68. Well, there you go. So you live and learn. So with all of this going on,
people under about 30 at the moment.
Yeah. Well, I was heartbroken. I think I said last week that I've been working all my working life. I'm now 55. I said 56, but I'm actually 55. I'm 56 later this year. And I got a letter from the Chancellor last year saying your state pension is going to kick in at 66. So that I worked out, that's just done me out of 12 grand. That's the state pension and enhancements that I was expecting to get. And that letter cost me £12,000 for the national insurance I'd already been paying in. Made me very happy. So The real issue is the government dealing with the ageing population. The subject that we keep banging on about, Harry brought it up, but auto-enrolment is the response. And this is the big idea. Government is transferring the responsibility for providing pensions for the aged from itself to employers. So the government is just letting go of the responsibility, trying to raise money through general taxation, because the state, as we all know, is broke, and it's trying to say, employers, you're going to have to fund the pensions of your employees. And it's a huge deal. Employers must set up a scheme. They must register it with the pensions regulator. They must also enrol eligible workers, whether the worker wants to be auto-enrolled or not. And they must collect employee contributions, and they must, they themselves, pay in. And there are massive fines for non-compliance. One of our clients posted on Facebook only this week, in the run-up to this show, that their boss had actually been trying to discourage people from joining the auto-enrolment pension scheme. I actually had to go back very quickly and say, it's very fortunate you haven't put the employer's name on here. Can I strongly recommend you delete this post and get it out? Because if your employer is caught, the pensions regulator is actively looking for companies that are breaking it, breaking the rules, because they want to actually get some high-profile scalps, and they actually posted the first few companies that have been fined only last month, because they want to get people to realise that they're absolutely serious. So this whole big deal about auto-enrolment is such a thing that I'm actually going to go through those 4 points again, because it's worth repeating. Employers must set up a pension scheme. And if they've already got one, they've got to make sure that that scheme is deemed a qualifying workplace pension. There'll be more of that later. Then they must register that pension scheme with the pensions regulator. They're actually going to be dealing with a financial services regulator. As somebody who's been dealing with a financial services regulator since 1988, when this first lot of regulation first came in, I can tell you that's a joyous experience. You got any regulators in the employment business, Paul?
The employment agencies used to have, we're not an employment agency, but employment agencies used to have, they used to be licensed, but that was stopped under the last Labour government.
Well, I suppose that was something for you, but we like, it's, for our financial advisors, it's like living in a permanent Ofsted, and this is what the sort of power that the pensions regulator is going to have.
I can tell you a story about the FSA.
Go on then.
In Canary Wharf, bless them. Some years ago, I was employed on a long-term contract to deliver in-house management and leadership training to management within the FSA.
Right.
Having delivered the first three programs, somebody within the FSA then said, you're not a qualified financial advisor. No. And I'm not giving financial advice, I'm doing leadership training. And they said, oh no, but it's a rule that all training must be by qualified people. And I said, I am qualified to give training in the area I'm giving training. And they went, yeah, but you're not an FSA. And I said, I'm not doing FSA training. And they agreed that I wouldn't do the training, but they'd pay me anyway. Which was rather nice.
Well, it was, but the sad thing is they were paying you with my money, because it's my last money. Yeah, I really like that one. Well, that's another one that I will... Another reason to dislike them. Yeah. So, we're going back to auto-enrolment now, after that interesting digression. But employers must set up a scheme, they must register it with the pensions regulator, they must auto-enrol eligible workers, whether the worker wants to join or not, they must collect employee contributions, and they must, they themselves, pay in. So the fines are even bigger if the employer says or does anything to discourage joiners. So it's a really, really big deal. You've got to take care of it. Get on with it. The point to bear in mind, however, is it does nothing for the self-employed. Something we'll come back to if Harry reminds me later on. But it's really crucial. So anybody who is employed, i.e. paid on PAYE, or anybody who is an employer, i.e. employs people, they are the ones that are going to be really collared by this. Now, before we come up to our first break, we'll just look quickly at the three types of worker that auto-enrolment recognises. And there are three types of workers. Nice and straightforward. You would imagine that you look around your workforce and you've just got one sort of worker. And now you've got three. And the first type of worker is an eligible worker. And he's the one that you're going to auto-enrol. And we'll talk about how we define that in a minute. And then you've got a non-eligible worker. Now that's an interesting one in itself, because I always thought the word was ineligible, but apparently it's a non-eligible worker. And then the last one is an entitled worker. And do you know what's really peculiar about the entitled worker pool?
No, I don't.
He's not entitled.
Tell me.
I am. He's not entitled to anything. They called it an entitled worker. It's a sort of triumph of marketing over common sense and reason, which I suppose it comes out of government, so you've got to expect it. Mm-hmm. So there are these three categories of worker, and you as the employer, your first job is to work out which perishing group your workers fit into. And there's a fairly major exercise to go through. So we'll let you just sort of gather your thoughts around that, and we'll play you something happy for the summer.
Jobsinkent.com.
And yet again, I keep pushing the wrong buttons and nothing works the way I want it to. I'm going to scream in a minute, but what we'll do is I will just push this up to the top of the thing there and then let go and see if my new trick actually works. And then I'll push that button, and with any luck, it works. Paul, your training is superb. Mr. Gary Barlow is up for you.
A broken heart, and only me to blame. For every single part, no science or religion could make this whole. To be loved but never loved, to have but never hold. It's a life alone and a desperate need to be held, to be loved so. Gonna take a bit of getting used to, but I know what's right for you. Take a bit of getting used to, but I know what's right for you. Let me go. A head full of madness, I'm nowhere safe. When tears aren't big enough, our love turns into hate. It's a life alone and a death to be loved so. This is gonna take a bit of getting used to, but I know what's right for you. Fly high, let me go. The sky will take your soul.
Radio.
I love that song by Gary Barlow. It's fantastic. You might ask, what is the relevance to get of Gary Barlow to a financial show? Well, just mention the three-letter word, tax, anywhere in his presence, and there is my justification. So we had a look at auto-enrollment. We've had a look that every employer has to play. We've had a look at the fact that all employees are going to be auto-enrolled, whether they want to be or not. That's all very good fun. And we then had a chat about the fact that there are three categories of worker. Now, the real issue is, it's all done on age and wage. So how old you are at the moment and how much you earn. And there are three numbers that you need to know in the current tax year. The first one is what I call the hurdle. And the hurdle is, unless you're earning over £10,000, you are not automatically auto-enrolled. Which is quite handy. So that's the first bit.
Over £10,000.
Over £10,000.
Okay.
But then if you earn £10,000 or £10,001, then all your earnings between 5772, an arbitrary figure picked out of the ether by some political group somewhere, all your earnings between 5772 and 10,001 are then included for auto-enrollment purposes, which is great fun. And then all the contributions stop on earnings over £41,865, and they change them every tax year. So the first thing to remember is qualifying earnings start at the hurdle rate of £10,000, and then they're paid on banding earnings between £5,772 and £41,865. And we've got that little bit out of the way. You can write it down or call up for the white paper, and I'll tell you again how to do that. Go on, Paul.
Yeah, let me make sure I understand that. So if I'm paying someone £43,000, the deductions from the employer's point of view are only up to that top of that band at 41, whatever it was you said.
41,865, and they don't include the earnings on the first 5772.
Right.
So if somebody was earning, let's say, £45,000, because I can sort of do the maths on that, then you ignore the first £5,772 of earnings,
right,
and you only make a contribution, or you only have to make a contribution on earnings up to 41,865, and the earnings over 41,865 don't count.
Okay.
So if you've got lots of very highly paid workers,
right,
then your maximum pension contribution you're going to pay is 3% of the difference between 41,865 and 5772.
Right, okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Oh, good. I'm glad. All right, so let's now do the definition of an eligible worker. An eligible worker is an employee working or ordinarily working in the UK who is aged between 22 and state pension age, with qualifying earnings above the income tax personal allowance threshold, which is currently £10,000. So the key question there is, you can usually work out who may or may not be over 22, but unfortunately they all seem to look so perishing young to me these days. I don't know if you find that, Paul, but everybody looks really young to me now. It's probably because I'm so old. But and then state pension age. Now, I find that the really difficult one, because these days you used to say 40 was the sort of the new 30. Well, I think 60 is the new 30. I mean, there are an awful lot of people are 60. My new next door neighbour is 74. He pilots a private plane. He's got a Harley Davidson motorcycle, and he is fit and vibrant and everything else at 74. In 1946, he would have been dead.
Yeah,
it's absolutely amazing. And his wife is 70, and she passed for 60 in my head. So I know they're in France, so I'm quite safe. But
I think I mentioned this the other week as well. The Office of National Statistics brought out a statistic the other day that said 30% of all people born after 1980 will live past 100 years.
Yeah, I think you heard that from me.
Yeah.
That's an amazing
statistic. It means that an awful lot of the population are going to be retired longer than they were at work.
And that's going to give them a real issue when they're trying to find some money.
Yeah.
Okay, so an eligible worker is an employee working in the UK who's aged between 22 and state pension age, but you've got to know when their state pension age is, and that's going to depend on when they were born, and you've got to look them up individually on a super website to find it out, or contract it out to somebody else to do it for you. And if you've got a couple of dozen workers, that's an afternoon's work for somebody. Harry, we said we'd get you to do the other two, so we've got the non-eligible and the entitled workers. Would you like to give us the definition of those, please?
Of course, yeah. The information that Simon's just given you and the information I'm about to give you also comes from the 256 pages of helpful guidance from the pension regulator. The other two categories are the non-eligible job holder. Essentially, this is anybody that's either between the ages of 16 and 21, or state retirement age and 74. and earn between, or earn between 5772 and £10,000 a year. Non-eligible basically means they're, which is strange, means they are eligible to join the pension scheme, but they're not eligible to get contributions from the employer. So that if they can opt in, and they can pay in themselves, they can opt in, and if they opt in, the employer has to contribute as well.
I'm glad you said that.
Okay, the third category, the entitled worker, is a strange definition, as Simon has already mentioned, because they're not entitled to a great deal. This is anybody that earns under 5772 per year. They're entitled to join the scheme. They're entitled to pay in themselves, but they're not entitled to anything that the employer puts in. The employer doesn't have to put anything in at all.
Right.
So it's a strange definition. The fun and games with this also, the employer has to reassess all the workers every time they do their payroll. So if you do payroll weekly, you've got to recategorise every one of your workers every single week. An absolute logistical nightmare.
Is this part of the bonfire of red tape?
Apparently it's jumped off the bonfire and it's now thriving at a rate of knots. Yeah. And I think they've poured ice on that one. I mean, the reality of the situation is the problem is huge. Mm. And the pensions are hugely tax efficient, tax worthy, and they are very useful tools. But the problem is, to stop rich people exploiting the system, they have to put a lot of very complicated rules in there, which just confuse the hell out of ordinary people who only wanted to put a couple of £100 a month away and save for their retirement in an effective way.
Yeah.
So effectively, a pension plan is a very, very simple vehicle, in essence. It's just a savings place to put your money until you retire.
Yeah.
And then you get an income out the other end. And it gets lots of tax breaks. Now that's all the average person actually needs to know.
Right.
Certainly all he wants to know.
Mm.
But the rules are so complicated, primarily to stop rich people exploiting the system and employers taking the mick.
Mm.
So we've talked about the three categories of employee, we've talked about how the entitled are not entitled to anything, we've talked about how the non-eligible can ask to join and the employer has to contribute, and we've talked about eligible workers who are automatically enrolled. But we haven't really talked too much about the cost. So let's have a quick look at what the cost is going to be. And the employers ultimately are going to have to contribute at least 3% of this banded earnings figure. So if all your staff earn over £10,000 a year, then you're going to have to put in 3% of their earnings between 5772 and whatever it is they earn. If you've got staff that earn under £10,000 a year, then for them you're not going to have to contribute. But as a sort of working as a working sum, the cost is going to be the thick end of 3% of payroll. It won't be quite 3% of payroll because, of course, you're going to miss off the first 5772.
Yeah, and of course that's on top of employer's national insurance.
That's on top of employer's national insurance and on top of anything else that you're doing. So it's
about inflation at all.
No, not even slightly. But I tell you what, they were worried about the election, because the other thing they did, recognising that the most of the economic recovery we've got in this country is coming from small business, they suddenly realised that they were going to act, they've been phasing auto-enrolment in, which is something we haven't talked about yet, but they've been phasing auto-enrolment in, and they suddenly realised that all the smaller employers were going to have to start grappling with this just in the run-up to the next general election, because we're on a fixed-term parliament. And you know what they did? You'll never believe it. They pushed the staging dates, which is the time that small companies have to join in. They have to join in at their staging date. They pushed the staging dates back the other side of the election.
No.
A political fix, I think so. It was just absolute classic. So when you're fully engaged with auto enrolment as an employer, you're going to have to put in 3% of payroll or thereabouts.
Mm.
The employees are going to have to put in 4% of their earnings, and the government is going to contribute 1%, which is effectively the tax relief on the employer's 4%. So the total of 9% is going to go into this scheme. So it's a very attractive vehicle. It's a very attractive medium. It's very, very good news for the employee, because in return for their contribution, they're getting tax relief and a contribution from the employer.
Mm. Now, that only doubles overnight, effectively.
So exactly that.
Great.
Mm. And the interesting thing is, I actually genuinely had a question on the money talk underscore guru Twitter feed. I've got to get my tongue around that. I'm going to say that again because I messed it up. On the money talk underscore guru Twitter feed, there was a question. The question was, what's better, ISA or pension? I'm going to let Harry answer that one and see what he comes up with.
Well, that's a very good question. If you asked me a year or two ago, it wasn't a straight answer, because the rules on pensions on getting the money back out again made it a hard decision to make, and many clients were saying, well, actually, I'd prefer the flexibility of the ISA because I can get my money out when I want to spend it, whatever I want.
Yeah.
But with the new regulations that are coming in next year on pensions, effectively enabling us to draw our pensions as and when we want to, pensions are a clear winner again.
I think you're absolutely right. I think you're absolutely right. When people used to say to me, well, I like ISAs because I can get the money out more easily, one of the things I always used to say is, but why are you saving this money in the first place? You just said, what's the best way to save for my retirement, ISA or pension? And if you say, well, I like saving for my retirement in an ISA so I can take the money out, it's actually not really achieving the objective of saving for your retirement. Now, some people say, well, I want to put more money away, but I want the safety net of being able to get money out if I need it, because that could be a potential problem. And you say, okay, we'll put half your savings in an ISA so you've got access if you need it, and the other half in a pension. But the reality is, because of the tax relief, and for higher rate taxpayers, that tax relief is effectively 66% of what you put in. You put in a grand, the government puts in £667. So that's a massive win for higher rate taxpayers. The tax relief and the employer contribution, pensions really, really do very well. Now, the drawback always used to be that you got to retirement, you had to buy an annuity, and everybody knows that annuities are not the most sexy thing you can do with your money, with a return of about 5.5%. But, of course, what we've now got is the Chancellor's announcement in the budget that effectively means you can take out as much money as you want whenever you want it. But the only point to bear in mind is after the first quarter has gone, which is tax-free, everything else comes out at your highest rate of tax.
Having said that, obviously, there's lots of options for us as financial advisors to help clients take out money beyond that 25% as tax efficiently as possible. And this is where we can work with clients to try and make them get the most from their pension.
I should have thought of saying that. It's very good. It's a very good point. It's very, very important. So the real issue is employers are going to have to contribute, employees are going to have to contribute, there is going to be a tax break. And the best bit is that the employer and employee contributions are being phased in. So you don't actually have to put in any more as an employer or employee than 1% of your contributions up till September 2016. So you're not having to start immediately day one on 3%. You only have to put in 1%. So if you've got your £45,000 a year worker in your business pool, then it's only going to cost you 1%, which gives you a little bit of a chance to sort it out. By 2017, it's going to be 2%, and it doesn't click in until October 2017 that it goes up to 3%. So there's a staging process that you can get involved in that effectively means you don't have to find all the money straight away. And as an employer, that is a massive advantage, because if you don't actually do something about it, you could have a huge problem, and doing it in stages is very useful. But, and here's a big but, if you are in the business of quoting for long-term contracts, I think a contract cleaners is an obvious one, or manufacturing, which is going to take a couple of years or whatever, and you do your costings and your budgets on the basis of a known payroll and an expectation of salary, but you don't factor in the fact that you're going to have to put 1, 2 or 3% of that payroll into pension, you could lose 2 or 3% of your profit. Mm. Now, what's the average profit margin most employers, net profit margin most employers are working to in the middle of a recession or coming out of a recession? 5 or 6%? Mm. So if you end up taking 3% of your profit out, it's a labour intensive, but let's pretend it's 3% of your profit goes straight out, then you've just halved your profit overnight as a result of the implementation of auto-enrolment. So there is a massive, massive imperative to really think forwards now and plan what your payroll is going to look like, how you're going to pay your staff, and when you're going to introduce auto-enrolment so you can budget properly and get your pricing right for jobs. Otherwise, you can find yourself pricing yourself out of business.
Absolutely. And for most small businesses, it's a cash flow issue as well.
Well, it is, which is why they've done it in stages. So the 1% increment, they're hoping you're not going to notice. But if somebody took 1% off my bottom line and they've just done it, because I've got people that work for me, then I would notice. You know, it has a real impact on your bottom line.
I wasn't being facetious when I said earlier, it's going to have a massive impact on inflation. Because, you know, in my businesses, I'm just going to put my prices up to cover loads of costs.
Absolutely.
The only positive thing is that all employers in this situation, it's not just some employers, but all employers are going to do it, so it's across the board. So as you say, it will affect inflation.
It will affect inflation massively. You know, you can't just keep lumping costs on businesses and expect it to come out of the money tree.
Our thin air. Well, the money tree, of course, is perceived by government as being the employer's back office, back pocket, because we're all doing so spectacularly well, having been brought to our knees by the last recession as a bunch of businesses. Okay, so we've looked at the workers, we've looked at the requirement to auto-enrol, we've looked at the different groups, we've looked at the costs. Let's talk a little bit about admin, because admin is actually a huge part of this exercise. It is a huge part of this exercise. Record keeping and being able to prove to the pensions regulator that you've done the right thing at the right time and that you can prove that you did it is going to be a big part of the compliance regime for auto-enrolment. Now, those of you that have not had the pleasure of dealing with financial services regulators in person before need to be aware of a little saying that financial advisors have, which is, if it's not in writing, it didn't happen. Now, financial advisors didn't invent that. Well, that was effectively invented by the pensions regulator, well, in fact, by the FSA. And when they start looking at financial advisors' files historically, they say, well, there's nothing about this in writing, so we're going to assume it didn't happen. And you started going, but we know we had the conversation. Well, you can't prove it. It's not in writing. It didn't happen. And the same sort of test is going to be set up. The same sort of hurdle is going to be put there for employers when the pensions regulator is going to say, well, did you auto-enroll Joe Smith when he hit 22? And the answer is, well, yeah, I did, but he didn't want to join, so we sort of fudged it slightly. Well, where's the exchange of letters? Where's your records? Where's your files? What's your process? How did you deal with it? And most employers are going to be sitting there like drowning fishes, and you can't do it on the radio, but... with your mouth wide open, sort of blowing Paul kisses across the studio here. But it's going to be a big issue. So you're going to need to buy into some sort of admin system. Now, Sage, one of the major accounting packages used by many companies, much beloved by their accounts departments to a man, will be able to buy a module that deals with it for you, and it keeps a lot of the records. But if you don't use Sage, or you don't buy the add-on, or you don't understand it, then you've got to look at other avenues to keep proper records. So there's a whole pile of things to think about. Now, the pensions regulator will write to you as the employer a year before you have to auto-enrol. So you get a year's notice from the pensions regulator, and it says, dear employer, in 1 year's time, you're going to have to start doing auto-enrolment. And that is going to hopefully set a few hairs running, and people are going to start waking up and thinking, I've got to do something. So when are these letters going to go out? Well, they're going to go out a year in advance of individuals' staging dates. Now, staging dates for the average employer first started in October 2012, and we started with the mega employers. So the ICIs, the Tescos, the companies that had loads and loads of employees. And it's been going down over time, so that smaller companies with smaller number of employees are being caught later, and the big boys are having to do the hard work because they've got the resources, and that was actually halfway fair.
Having said that, apparently the pension regulator are investigating 500 of the bigger companies who even they haven't got it right.
500? I hadn't heard that.
One of the highest profile ones is Dunelm Mill.
Goodness me. Well, that's there's a new Dunelm Mill opening in Ashford. I think it's just opened. I might have to charge around there and offer our services. If you have between 50 and 249 staff, your staging date is going to be somewhere between April 2014 and April 2015. If you have between 30 and 49 staff, your staging date is going to be somewhere between 1st of August 2015 and 1st of October 2015. If you've got fewer than 30 staff, your staging date is going to be somewhere between 1st of January 2016 and 1st of April 2017. New companies that were set up after April 2012 don't have to worry about it until May 2017. So if you're a new business, they're giving you a little bit of a chance to get yourself sorted out, which is very good news. But the point to bear in mind, and this probably is the real warning message for this, when you start looking at the numbers for this, historically it's been relatively straightforward. Big employers, one employer, deals with tens of thousands of employees, and they're all auto-enrolled at the same time, and there'll be a massive project team at the employer's side, there'll be a fairly big project team at the pensions regulator and at the pension provider, whoever's sorting it out for them, and they'll get that sorted out, and you'll be able to deal with it on a spreadsheet. It's only one case, with lots of numbers, but that's just a new line on a spreadsheet, so that's relatively straightforward. When you get to the micro-employers, who are employing between 3 and 25 staff, there will be tens of thousands of employers trying to set up a new pension scheme all at the same time. Now, when you think about it, there's probably only 30 companies in the country who are capable of setting up a qualifying workplace pension. And they are going to have huge problems. Has anybody ever tried to buy any tickets for a gig recently? You know, Gary Barlow, we played Gary Barlow earlier, Gary Barlow's tickets were sold out, I think, for his tour last year, within 24 hours of going online, and everybody was complaining they couldn't get through on the website. Why? Because tens of thousands of people at the same time were trying to register and buy a ticket. Well, guess what that's going to be like in pension land? It's going to be hugely entertaining. And there's a thing, if you Google auto-enrollment capacity crunch, you actually get over 11,000 hits. And there's one fairly near the top from the pensions regulator saying there's no capacity crunch, the industry's been set up to deal with this, it will be fine. Well, I disagree, sir, and I don't think it's going to be that straightforward. So all I would say to you, if you're an employer, is forward planning is absolutely crucial. You really, really, really need to extract the digit and do something about this, because if you don't, it's going to come as a horrible shock when you and 10,000 other people are banging on the door of the relatively few financial advisors who are dealing in this area, saying, help, I've got a real problem. And with that happy note, we'll move on. Gary Moore. It's just a wonderful, wonderful guitar player. Wonderful guy. Super, super music. Ah, I could listen to that all afternoon. It makes you want to be in Paris, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a lovely track, isn't it?
Yeah, Parisian Walkways, yes. Mm. And we were lamenting the fact that half the great musicians that I really like are no longer with us, and there's another one. Mm. Never mind. Well, having set all the employers' teeth on edge with a diatribe about auto-enrolment and responsibilities, let me just remind you that you can get our white paper from www.fffp.co.uk. That's www.fffp.co.uk. You can ask for it at moneytalk_guru. And there was something else you could do, and I can't think what it is, but it'll come back to me later. Never mind. Auto-enrolment, done. The other thing I promised to talk about today was investment perfection. Have you had any perfect investments, Paul?
Perfect investments?
Perfect investment. What's the perfect investment for you?
I don't know. I don't know what a perfect investment would be. It would be low risk and massive returns, I suppose.
Well, that's a chunk of it. I mean, I think we have a little presentation we take all our clients through when we're talking about investments, and we say that the perfect investment offers spectacular capital growth. So there's your massive returns. It offers phenomenal income, which is great. No risk, so you got two out of the three. So Paul's been around the block there. He's doing my job for me. The other important one is you don't want to pay any tax, so we'll have no tax. Perfect liquidity, so you can get your money out whenever you want it. And of course, whoever sets it up for you and the financial advisor works for free. Yeah. So if you knew nothing else, you knew the last one wasn't going to happen. But in point of fact, the truth of the matter is you can't get fantastic capital growth, great income, no tax, free financial advice, and a whole bit bundled together. It just doesn't exist. So the trick for everybody is going to be that it's a straightforward trade-off, a compromise between something that offers some growth and probably a degree of risk, or something that opens a steady return but not much risk. And there's that sort of trade-off. But what is risk? And this is a really interesting question, because most people just imagine that the risk is I could lose my money. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a pretty good risk. So you say, okay, you could lose your money. That's the risk that you're concerned about. So how do you deal with that risk? Well, I'll put it under the mattress. Okay. So what happens if you're burgled? Well, I lose my money. So there's a risk if you put it under your mattress. Well, what about if I put it in the building society? Well, it's safe in the building society. Remember Northern Rock? There was a little panic. Now the great news is there is this financial services compensation scheme knocking about the place, which means that people have got protection as long as they invest under £85,000 with one banking licence. But it doesn't alter the fact that you've got to jump through a number of hoops to get it, and it's a real pain, and it's very worrying and unsettling. But even cash deposits carry an element of risk. But the real risk then for cash deposits is not about losing money, it's about losing spending power. And that is the one word answer of?
Inflation.
Inflation, absolutely right. And what's inflation at the moment? Well, inflation is probably about 2.5%, it varies. And of course it depends on who you are, because if you're old, the things you need to buy make your inflation rate a lot higher than the sort of basket they use for retail price index and CPA at the moment. So you've got to be very careful about what you measure on the inflation front. But nonetheless, inflation is as low as it has been for a good long time at 3%, but it still means if you put 10 grand away on the 1st of January 2014 at 3% inflation, then you'll only be able to buy £9,700 worth of stuff on the 1st of January 2015. So you've actually just locked yourself in to a guarantee of devalued capital in exchange for an interest rate return of about 1.5% after tax. So the question is, what does risk look like to you? And there's this huge debate in financial services, the regulators are getting involved, the clients are getting involved, trying to work out what is a good way of investing your money. If you put it all in Australian gold mining shares, if you strike gold, or if you put it in an oil company and they strike oil, you could get mega returns. The problem is, 9,999 times out of 10,000, they come up dry. And for most people, that's an unacceptable risk. And by the way, I agree with you. You could go onto the stock market. The stock market is a traditional safe haven for money in some people's eyes, and a massive casino in the eyes of others. But the reality is, over the longer term, it hasn't done too badly. But it depends on what time frame you look at. And if you happen to try and take your money out on a bad day, it's a real issue. So the stock market is not necessarily the greatest place to be if you're risk averse. But on the other hand, if you don't get into the stock market, you could be guaranteeing yourself a really poor return. So I suppose we've got stocks and shares and Australian gold mines at one end of the risk spectrum and cash deposits at the other. I'll give Harry a chance to jump in. What do you think's in the middle, Harry?
Well, there's another type of investment called bonds, which essentially is loans to companies and loans to governments, which provide slightly better returns than ordinary deposits. So it helps hedge against inflation to a certain extent.
It does. And of course, those notes also change in value. So if you get the right sort of bonds, you can actually see their value appreciate over time, depending on what happens to the basic underlying interest rate, and you can get a decent income. Other asset classes that we can think of somewhere in the middle, probably commercial property. That's a good bet. And a lot of business people like commercial property because they usually use their pension funds to buy commercial property, quite often their own, which is highly tax effective because it means if you have a capital, if you have a commercial property in a pension scheme, you don't pay capital gains tax when you sell it at a profit, which is an advantage because if you own it in the business or personally, you pay tax, and that's not so good. So commercial property is an attractive investment to have somewhere in the middle. But the reality is, what you really need is some form of diversification. And in fact, there was a Nobel Prize winning economist who worked out that about 96%, 95% of all investment performance over time comes out of diversification rather than market timing or stock selection.
Yes, Harry Markowitz.
Harry Markowitz, absolutely right. He got a Nobel Prize for economics just a few years ago for this thing. He wrote a book called Modern Portfolio Theory, which is the underpin for a lot of financial thinking even today. Now, there's a lot of people saying, well, we just had a crash and every asset class went down. Yeah, every so often you're going to have a 50-year event or a 20-year event, whatever you want to call it. But the interesting thing is the stock market has pretty much recovered to where it was. And in fact, I'm old enough to remember 1974. Paul was already a granddad in 1974.
Was indeed.
He was indeed. But in 1974, the oil-producing states in the Gulf worked out that the Western world depended on oil completely. And the OPEC, the oil-producing countries group, decided that what they were going to do was double the price of oil overnight. And there was carnage, absolute carnage. Stock market had been bubbling away quite nicely for some time, ever upward increasing circles. Lots of people had been taking bets on the fact the stock market would continue to go up. And when the OPEC doubled the price of oil, world stock markets went through the floor. And we do a little presentation on this, and I'm often known to stand up and lay it on with a trowel and talk about blood in the streets of the city of London and Wall Street. People were jumping out of windows. I kid you not, it was a bloodbath. It really was. It was an absolute tragedy. But the interesting thing is that while the stock market fell off a cliff in 1973 or thereabouts, within 3 years it had fully recovered to where it was before. So all the speculators that were in for a quick kill for 5 minutes caught a horrible, horrible cold. Whereas all the longer term investors who've been in there for a good few years, they just sat there and they didn't worry about it. So one of the things we say to our clients is you could put money into any form of investment today. Say you put £100,000 away. And in 6 months' time, your valuation statement could say 80,000 quid. And we actually have to say to clients, but you don't care. And the client quite rightly says, well, I've just lost 20 grand. I do care. This is my life savings you've just been so glib about. And to which I reply, but the truth of the matter is, you don't want the money then. It's 1973. And 1975, 76 is coming when your money will come back. So you've got to just be very sensible about how you look at these things. You can't take a short-term view because all of this program is predicated on the assumption that we're all going to live a good few years. Mm. And if we don't do something about it and plan for the longer term, we're going to have a problem.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, Warren Buffett, the sage of Omaha, has been saying this for donkey's years. He always invests for the long term. I guess the one fear, even when you know that, is that at the time you come to retire and you want it, you want to hope to heaven that it's not 1973 and it is 1975.
The important thing is to plan short term as well as long term. Yeah. If you plan with a good financial advisor, they will talk to you very, very much about the short term needs and make sure you've got plenty for the short term needs, yeah, so you never have to come out at the wrong time. Yeah. And the only real risk with longer term investments is coming out at the wrong time.
Yeah.
You want to buy cheap and sell expensive.
Exactly.
If things crash for a while, doesn't really matter unless you need to cash it at that time. A good example, for example, is you buy a property to let out. The face value of your property might drop from 100k to 80k, but if the rental income's still coming in, you don't need to sell it then.
Yeah.
And 10 years later it's worth 150, the fact it drops to 84 doesn't matter at all.
Absolutely.
It's a very good example. I'm going to nick that. I've not used that one. I rather like that. Because those of us who've had buy-to-let properties for a few years have seen that happen. Mm. And it's very disconcerting. But, of course, the thing that happened when the prices went down is that the rental yields effectively went up. Mm. So, and interest rates fell to try and deal something with the capital value. So you actually found you were making quite a nice income, even though on paper your property portfolio had gone down in value. Yeah. And I'm pleased to say that it has now recovered a little bit. So I'm feeling a lot more comfortable. But it's a very, very good example. Mm. So thank you for that, Harry. The real issue, really, for everybody, when you're thinking about investment, is you've got to think about your time frame. So, Paul's comment, very true. What you don't want to do is retire just at a time when your investments fall off a cliff, because you need all your money. But actually, may I respectfully suggest that even then, you don't really care. Because in point of fact, we're going to be talking about pension drawdown and getting money out of pensions in later shows.
Sure.
But in point of fact, the old advice used to be, take a quarter of your pension fund out, day one, as a tax-free lump sum, and squirrel it away, because you can then make sure you can hang on to your money. Well, the truth of the matter is, with the new drawdown rules, you're probably better off leaving all your pension fund intact and just taking out of it, because let's face it, a pension is nothing more than a super ISA in the current rules, except you just pay tax when you get the money out. Take out bits of money as you need it, when you need it, pay that bit of tax when you need it. So in other words, instead of thinking, I need my pension fund on my 65th birthday or on your 67th birthday or 68th birthday, you're now thinking, I need to be skimming income off that pension fund for the rest of my life, and I could be living to 85, 90, 95 or even 100, as we keep saying. I mean, you should be really quite encouraged listening to our show, because we keep talking about people living for darn nearly forever, and that's got to be jolly good news. But the reality of the situation is, you've got to think in a slightly different way. We've all got used to the idea of thinking about retirement as being a destination, but in fact it's just the commencement of a journey, and you've got to plan on that basis. We've swung back to retirement, but really we're just going to finish off on investments. So we've said that the trick is to make sure that you don't put all your eggs in one basket. We don't put it all in stocks and shares when you might get a 1973 type crash. You don't put all your money in deposit, because you might actually see that inflation erodes the value of your capital, and at the moment you're going to get derisory returns, and I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. And so what you then have to do is think about, well, spreading it around. And the word associated with perfect investments and indelibly inscribed on my forehead in words of 10 feet high, which is quite a big forehead, is diversification. Don't put all your money in one basket. Have some cash deposits. Have some corporate and some government bonds. Have some commercial property. Have some stocks and shares, but not just in the UK, in different markets, because we're a global village now. You probably don't want to be in the emerging markets in Mexico and places like that, unless you've got a lot of money and you're an experienced investor and you just put a little bit away. But in the major and more mature investment markets, where there's a high degree of regulation and perhaps far less volatility than you might see elsewhere, spread your money around between those markets and keep them under constant review. Now, it's a bit of an advert, but at Facts and Figures, one of the things that we do is we actually say to our clients, we'll put that money away for you, and we'll value your money four times a year and write to you with fund switch recommendations four times a year. And what that means is you're constantly checking that you're in decent funds that are performing well, and if a fund manager leaves the company and goes off somewhere else and sets up in competition, you don't suddenly discover that your money's now in the doldrums. You actually have it well spread between different assets, between different fund managers in different asset classes, and you're in a situation where your money's well spread, and you can be reasonably confident that it isn't going to disappear down the loo in short order, which is what you're trying to avoid. So, the perfect investment offers spectacular capital growth. It doesn't exist, but you can get halfway reasonable returns. The perfect investment offers halfway reasonable income. Depending on how you invest, income is still possible to achieve, but there is an interesting way about interesting financial services argument about, do you really want income or do you want to strip capital? And maybe we'll use that next week. And then you want to make sure that you're well diversified, that you want to make sure that you avoid the volatility, and you want to make sure that your financial advisor looks after you and does you a really good deal. So I think we're cruising towards the end of the show for this week. My thanks to you, Mr. Paul Andrews.
My pleasure.
My thanks to you, Mr. Harry Masson. Pleasure to have you here. We're going to go and find somewhere nice and cold and a nice cold beer, because the truth of the matter is we got no air conditioning in here and it's hot as it could possibly be.
Temp Network have hundreds of vacancies across West Kent. We offer ongoing work, weekly pay and a variety of shift patterns to suit your needs. Visit us at www.tempnetwork.co.uk or call Tunbridge Wells 531-777.
Let's work it to the bone, 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 come on, work.
They ought to get a rich man to vote like that, singing
song, song of the South, sweet potato pie and I shut my mouth, gone, gone with the wind.